many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the day from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom?
The future is uncertain. I know this. Death is inevitable. I know this. But one thing is certain. As free men, it is our right to live unencumbered and in peace. And those times are quickly drawing to an end. And in these times, peace is certainly an illusion. And as the chains grow tighter, our ability to slip those chains increase incrementally with every passing moment. Inaction is no longer an option. It's time to raise our voices like a cacophony of thunder and lightning and tell the masters no more. And this is Nighthawk, and I say, for myself, no more. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, because the freedom is slipping away. Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of whose program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Barbara Jean Lindsay is an internationally acclaimed psychic, spiritual healer, author, and founder of the online mystery school Esoteric University. As the cosmic oracle, she is a conduit to the powers that be to answer your questions about your future self, past lives, current career, love. She shines light into the darkness to illuminate what was, what may be, and beyond. The readings and advice given by Barbara Jean Lindsay are for entertainment purposes only, should not take the place of any medical, legal, or financial advice given to you by a qualified professional, and are not a substitute for medical, legal, or financial advice. If you need a doctor, call a doctor. If you need to be expanded, call the Cosmic Oracle.
Radio, freedom's Slips.com.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for Free Association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And you will catch the Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's the Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us. We're already here.
You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio.
Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Michael Rupertz from the wilderness, and started reading things, and then I realized that for the first time, I think I realized that what we read or what we read in the mainstream media, what we hear in the news on the television is not what really happened. And that got me interested. I compiled a book, edited a book actually of articles, which was to be published on the first anniversary in 9/11/2002. And it had been composed and the publisher backed off. That was the Musharraf regime, and many years later he told me that he had been advised by somebody not to publish the book. It would not have been good for him or for me as well. But I kept on reading, and when you start reading, then you start writing as well. I always say writing is a byproduct of reading. And it is an area which then takes you on to other things like the JFK assassination, the world wars, because all these things are interconnected. The Pearl Harbor incident and so on and so forth. So that's how I got interested in these things.
Okay, and well, let's jump to your article on the Xerius moneylenders and assassinations in history. And you know, rather than trying to go through the whole history, maybe we could just start with the issue that's become topical now as RFK Jr. is challenging Joe Biden for the Democratic nomination for the presidency here in the United States. And RFK Jr. has let it be known that not only does he reject the official explanations of the murder of his father, Robert F. Kennedy Sr., and his uncle, John F. Kennedy, but he says that the CIA killed them. He's flat out said that.
Yes.
And
Yes,
go ahead.
You're right. And that's a very dangerous thing for him to do, because there's a very interesting incident mentioned in the book by James Douglas, JFK and the Unspeakable. It is an incident involving a man named Wayne January, who is now dead. Wayne January was working. He was partly owner of an airline called American Aviation Company. And just around the time, just before the time of assassination, it had been sold to another company known as Houston Air, which later turned out to be a CIA front company. And there were two incidents. On the 20th, I think, John Kennedy was assassinated on the 22nd. And on the 20th, he had a visit from three persons, two men and one woman. One of the men stayed in the car, and the couple came in, and they wanted to hire a Cessna. And their destination was somewhere in Yucatan Peninsula. And they were asking questions, and he said he grew suspicious, and he refused to give them the Cessna. But when John Kennedy was assassinated, he saw the picture, and he could immediately recognize that the third person who stayed back in the car was Lee Harvey Oswald. But not only that, he was working on setting a DC-3 ready by midday January 22nd with a person who was a pilot and who did not speak much to him. But one day before the assassination, this pilot told him that they're going to assassinate your president. And he said, you mean Kennedy? And he said, yes, they're going to assassinate Kennedy. And he said that he was involved in the Bay of Pigs assassination and so on and so forth. And the people are very angry with him. And the next day, of course, John Kennedy was assassinated. And so he walked up to this person. He had the DC-3 ready and was putting the luggage onto the plane. And he said, you know, have you heard the news? He said, yes, it will happen as I told you. And I've told you that they want RFK very bad, and they will kill every Kennedy who will be in a position to get into the White House. And for 30 years, January did not tell this to anyone until he confided in an English writer, Matthew Smith. And Matthew Smith then used a pseudonym. And subsequently, when Wayne January died, he used his actual name with the permission of his wife. But, you know, Kennedy, he told this to him on the 21st and 22nd of January, 1963. And then...
I'm sorry, do you mean November?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, the
November. November. The day JFK was assassinated and the day before that. And you know RFK was assassinated subsequently. And then the son of John Kennedy died in a very mysterious plane crash. And he had been publishing a magazine by the name George, I think, in which he had been hinting at things. And he was quite popular and he could have become a candidate. And now RFK Jr. has said that CIA was behind the assassination of his father and his uncle. And if RFK gets into a position where he will be nominated and he might win, then something could happen, I think.
Right. And well, just in this past week, we had a meeting of Silicon Valley billionaires come out for RFK Jr. And then we had a poll released yesterday showing mm-hmm. that RFK Jr. has a 30-point favorability lead over both Trump and Biden, which is extraordinary.
Very interesting.
Yes. Right. So that it's and at the same time that happened, RFK Jr. started mouthing Zionist talking points. so it kind of makes you scratch your head. And let's talk about your work in terms of the blaming these assassinations primarily on a kind of a banking cabal that creates the money supply by lending money into existence at interest. There are other interpretations of the Kennedy assassinations that blame Israel. That is the argument that Michael Collins Piper first made, and that's been taken up by people like Laurent Guyonneau, is that JFK was a partisan of nuclear nonproliferation who was dedicated to shutting down Israel's nuclear program at Dimona. And so Ben Gurion, who, like the rest of the Israeli leadership, believed that this nuclear program was vital for their security, resigned in the early summer or late spring, I forget, of 1963, and then masterminded the assassination of Kennedy in order to put Johnson, Israel's agent, into the White House. And, of course, then they conspired with Johnson to wage the 1967 war of aggression and to attack the USS Liberty. So that's the theory that basically blames the state of Israel and its partisans. And then there's this other theory that Kennedy's threatening the Federal Reserve and issuing Treasury money played a role, and that it was this bankster cabal that you talk about that was responsible, not so much just the state of Israel. So maybe you could talk about the distinction between the state of Israel and this banking cabal.
You see, the state of Israel is a Rothschild project. It was Rothschild who first purchased land in Palestine and started settling people there. And everybody knows how Rothschilds are respected in Israel. And they have also interests. There are oil interests and other interests in Israel as well. And there was a group which was raising money for the Israeli nuclear project, Abe Fortas and others, and that group also involved the Rothschilds and other bankers. So the Israeli nuclear project had the blessings of the banking cabal as well. And of course, Kennedy was doing too many things at the same time. He was issuing treasury banknotes, dollars, which would have replaced the Federal Reserve notes. He was blocking Israel's nuclear program, which was very important for the bankers, because Israel is very, very important for the bankers. It is supposed to be, Jerusalem would be, it is said that it will be the future capital of the one world state, which they are trying to set up. So if the Rothschilds and other bankers were involved in raising money for the Israeli nuclear project, and Kennedy was trying to stop it, he was essentially in the way of the bankers who wanted Israel to be a nuclear power so that it could hold complete sway in the Middle East. And therefore, these things are interconnected. And no assassination of such a high level can take place without the blessings of has called the board. He's the one who's written a book on Ellen Dulles and John Kennedy.
David Talbot wrote a book.
Yes, David Talbot has said that Ellen Dulles would never proceed, although he was not at that time the director of CIA, but he was involved, without having clearance from a board that runs matters and decides matters. Could be the Eastern establishment, which again is an arm of the bankers and part of the bankers. So I think the bankers are the key. If they give the go-ahead, then these things take place. And these assassinations are not, it's JFK is one assassination. Lincoln was assassinated. Others have been assassinated. So the money lenders and the bankers are always there when such assassinations take place, because they have a complete hold over societies because of the control of the money line. and their ability to print money, fiat money privately. And so when Mossad was involved or Angleton was involved, CIA was involved, they're all the same actually. And they work under the umbrella of the bankers who stay out of sight, but without them, nothing would take place.
That's very interesting. So RFK Jr. is campaigning to end the corrupt merger of state and corporate power. And there's no more extreme example of the corrupt merger of state and corporate power than the banking cabal, which has taken over the so-called Federal Reserve, which isn't really federal and doesn't really have any reserves. But yet the government is complicit in this rape of the currency by these private bankers. And so when RFK Jr. says he's campaigning to end this kind of corrupt merger of state and corporate power, and then right at the moment that his campaign is starting to look viable, he starts kowtowing to Israel making these ridiculous Israeli propaganda noises. What does that tell us about his campaign? Is it possible that he's sincere in wanting to end this kind of corruption and yet feels that to get into a position to do it, he has to say these things about Israel? And his father did something a bit like that. He, RFK Sr., he didn't really say strong supportive things about Israel, but he said kind of the minimum necessary. And that was enough so that they could set up a Palestinian patsy as the alleged assassin and blame Palestinians for it, because they could point to these things that RFK Sr. had said supporting Israel. So I'm wondering, like, how seriously should we take RFK Jr. in his quest to end this corrupt merger of corporate and state power, when in fact he's suddenly, you know, he's saying friendly things about Israel? He has, you know, he's clearly a member of the American elite. Whether he's defecting from it like Trump has to a certain extent, that's another question. So is he for real? And how do you interpret the contradiction between his professed purpose in running and the things he's saying about Israel?
Only time can tell, actually, because he probably is trying to win over Israel because he knows the lethal power of the bankers, and Israel is their arm, and they depend more on Israel than on anybody else for carrying out their projects, because there's a sense of loyalty because of the religious factor. But I think that the bankers will never trust any Kennedy. And again, even have you lost my voice? Hello? 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 Have you lost? Hello? The net is on. Skype is also on.
Yeah, you're still on the air.
Sure. Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
All right. So, as I was saying, that the bankers can never trust a Kennedy. They will never trust a Kennedy. No matter how much effort RFK Jr. makes to win their trust, they will never trust a Kennedy. And the slogan, of course, that he has, that he wants to end the merger of corporate power and the hold in politics, is very much against them. So if he tries to woo Israel, Israel is a project of the bankers, and Israel will... They're very clear about who's their friend and who's their enemy. And they, I don't think they will accept him. I have a feeling that they will not accept any Kennedy in office. Hello? Hello?
Yeah, it looks like we've lost Dr. Barrett. We're trying to get him back right now.
All right.
Guess he's run into some Skype problems again.
Yeah. I was afraid that I might get some problems because in this part of the world, the electric supply goes on and off, you know, but it's working at this time.
So it might be a minute or two here.
Doesn't matter. I can wait until we get the voice back.
But I actually agree with your point also that the bankers probably won't trust another Kennedy as well.
No. And they have things laid down, you know. When Wayne Jenvries was told on the 21st of November 1963 that they will not allow any candidate to get into power. That has been laid down and will not change.
So it looks like they're in a bit of a conundrum. I mean, they don't want Mr. Trump and they don't want Kennedy. So
Trump is the lesser of two evils for them, you know, Trump. But they have put Trump under tremendous pressure by these cases against him and, you know, trying to malign. But there's not much in the cases, I think. I've not studied them deeply, but about Russiagate, I had always known that there was nothing in that. And now there are other cases against him. Because he keeps saying that he would like to end the war. He doesn't want war with Russia. And that the military-industrial complex does not want. And now they have a Kennedy, so they have a very difficult situation at this point.
And do you think that the military-industrial complex wants to just have some sort of perpetual war going on?
Oh, yes. They want a lot of money. They want to keep people in a state of insecurity. They want to have controllable wars going on, because if things get out of control, then you don't know what will happen. And the Ukraine project, of course, is again a project in which the Israelis are also involved and the bankers are also involved, because it is, I think, it was part of the Khazar kingdom at one time, and they want to have another Israel too in that region. But it's not going to be easy, because Putin is quite clear about that.
Yeah, and you know, earlier there was a mention of the whole pact with the sort of a Russian, Chinese, Iranian, and
yes,
a BRICS-friendly
yes.
kind of world group. That I think from their perspective, they see America as kind of a rogue state that's abusing its influence and power, that, you know, was once presenting a honorable front, but then has basically used, you know, subterfuge and lies to perpetrate a serious offense to the rest of the world. And now they're being called out on it. People aren't standing for it anymore. And I think we've got Dr.
Oh,
Barrett back.
Hey.
Yeah. Yes.
Hey, hi, Mr. Rowe and Mujahid. I'm so sorry. I just got knocked off and the internet went out for a few minutes.
No problem.
So where were we before I was so rudely interrupted?
That was, we were discussing whether whether RFK, his quote owing to Israel, would be helpful for him or not. But it's my opinion that things have been laid down, and as on the 21st of January, 21st of November 1960, told me in January, we'll never trust a Kennedy. Assassinated John Kennedy, they assassinated Robert Kennedy, and I'm fairly certain that the death of John Kennedy Jr. was part of that. And so RF Kennedy Jr. is also in the same category for them. And the problem at this stage is that Trump is also popular, and Trump does not want war with Russia. And RF Kennedy wants to essentially carry out the same agenda which John Kennedy had, and essentially with regard to corporate power. I don't know if they will let...
Hello, Mujahid. I'm having some strange noises in the background, and you're fading in and out.
I don't hear any noises. I can hear your voice very clearly, and I was talking to Mr. Rowe, and that was also very clear.
Okay.
So,
yeah, maybe it's on my end.
Possible, yes, possible. So, Robert Kennedy, even if he is trying to woo Israel, there is a question mark on him, and because he is a Kennedy, and he knows that his father was assassinated, his uncle was assassinated, his cousin was assassinated. So, I don't know, it's going to be very difficult for him to get into the White House alive.
I would agree. And he would need the kind of miraculous change in sort of a groundswell of public opinion to get into the White House. And then he would need some really good security to stay alive.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because if you look at the assassination of John Kennedy, everybody betrayed him. The Secret Service betrayed him. The CIA betrayed him. The Mossad was in. Everybody, all the protocols that were to be observed in Dallas that day were not observed. Starting from the time he left the airport, the persons who were to stand at the rear were asked to get off. The vehicle did not have any cover. At the last minute, a change had been made, and a turn which slowed down the car to about 10, 11 miles per hour instead of the mandatory, 44 miles per hour or something like that. So all these things were there. So he will need it, but you never know, because the Americans, I always have felt that the American leadership, the people in office in the White House, do not really reflect what the Americans want. They are managed by others. And the American people are very good people. They have a lot of strength of character. And maybe if nature is kind enough, it might take Americans out of this situation where their governments are doing things which they don't want them to do, and their governments are pushing things in a direction which is not in the interest of America or of mankind or the rest of the world and of the ideals for which America was built. So maybe nature can be very kind also, and a change may occur, but the grip that the banking cabal has over the United States and Britain and other countries, it is very difficult to break that grip. But then, as in the Quran, God says, you know, you conspire and I also have my own plan. So maybe the Americans have, their government has done things which the Americans, if they would know, would not want them to be done. And maybe nature can be kind also. That possibility can never be ruled out.
Yeah, inshallah. So how do they get so unanimous in committing treason when they killed John F. Kennedy? As you say, they took away all of his security. And there were a lot of people that had to have been involved, and a much larger number that had to acquiesce passively. It's hard to imagine how they could engineer that kind of unanimity in such a bloody act of treason.
Going too fast for certain things. For example, the feeling in the southern states about the blacks, he was for their civil rights and he was moving ahead fast, and the Secret Service people, and there was one black Secret Service officer who that if Kennedy is killed, we are not going to try to save his life. So that prejudice was there. The military was also angry, and the bankers have think tanks, and they have hired intellect. They have purchased intellect, people who do the thinking for what they want to be, the strategy for what is to be done. They just have the target, and the strategy is then developed, and the interests of those people involved are also very much there. The Eastern establishment, of course, it is their power, it is their money, and they don't want that taken away from them. And then Johnson was also there, and Johnson was Jewish. His mother, his mother's mother, and his mother's grandmother, they were all Jewish. And that was not very well known at that time. So if they got rid of Kennedy, they had somebody they could rely upon very easily.
Right.
So that
kind of the power to influence things from behind the scenes to that extent obviously has grown up over many generations, as you suggest in your article. And I'm wondering about the role of secret societies in that.
Because
obviously this kind of activity does require a certain amount of secrecy, and it seems that Freemasonry and other similar groups are
part of this. You're right. I was writing a book on Kennedy's assassination, which I have actually submitted to the publisher. But it'll take a while before it comes out because paper has become very expensive in Pakistan. It is three times the price it used to be a few months ago. So in that, I noticed that every point where Kennedy was betrayed and was being obstructed, people of the Skull and Bones Society were involved, almost everywhere, whether it was Harry Brand, whether it was even Angleton and others. The Skull and Bones people were very much involved in failing Kennedy's move towards peace with Russia, a more peaceful world. And so secret societies are very much there and they're trained in secrecy. And it is possible, you know, look at the Manhattan Project. They were not people of secret societies. They were basically scientists and engineers and technicians. And there were so many people involved in that Manhattan Project for building the atomic bomb. But it remained a secret, you know. Nobody knew about it except the people involved. So it is possible to keep secrets, but for people who are trained to keep secrets, like being members of secret societies of Freemasons or Skull and Bones and others, it is very easy for them to do that because that is the way they are. And they know the price of faltering. If they betray the secrets, they may have to pay with their lives. I had a lady here who was a journalist, and she came to me about 7 years ago. And she said, my brother was a member of one of the fraternities, and she says that he is living in America, but he never talks about those fraternities. If I raise that subject, he just goes silent. So that kind of thing is there.
Right. Well, one of the many people who've been assassinated by these banksters and their allies, their secret societies, the military and intelligence agencies that they control, is Napoleon Bonaparte. And you just published a piece on him. It's a bit of a follow-up to the other one. And you argue that Napoleon was an enemy of the banksters. And the conventional history has been a bit more ambivalent in terms of his role with banking. But maybe you can go ahead and explain to us how Napoleon went up against the banksters.
There's a small book, A History of Central Banking and the Enslavement of Mankind, by Stephen Mitford Goodson. Stephen Mitford Goodson worked for the South African Reserve Bank. But he understood what was going on. And in his book, he has clearly, when he set up his bank, the Banque de France, on January 1880, a joint stock company, and it replaced...
I'm sorry, hello, Mujahid. I'm not hearing you.
Oh dear.
Okay, now you're back.
Okay.
If there's anything with your microphone that's going on that could be causing a click and the disappearance of your voice.
It is possible that, you know, can you hear me now?
Yes, you're fine now.
All right. So as I said, Central Banking and Enslavement of Mankind has emphasized... And it commenced operations on February 20 of that year. So he was very quick about that. And he had replaced by this bank 15 mainly Jewish, I'm quoting him, mainly Jewish private banking houses, which had been deeply involved in the events leading up to the French Revolution of 1789 to 1799. And these banks had charged rapacious rates of interest on loans to the French crown to the extent it was allocating over 50%.
What
he has written.
I'm sorry, but you
can't hear me?
Your connection keeps going in and out. And I just checked with the studio, and they're experiencing the same thing.
So maybe it's because of my movement of my head or something. So I'll keep my hand on my mic so that it doesn't move. You can hear me now?
Yes. Yes, we do
hear
you.
So it was the Banque de France which he had set up, and it had made franc the most stable currency in Europe. But then he was not allowed peace because he also had an agreement with the Sanhedrin of France to end usury. So the Jewish leadership in 1807 announced publicly that they will no longer charge interest, they will not engage in usury in return for certain freedoms that Napoleon had granted them. So there's a lot of confusion that is deliberately created about Napoleon, because Napoleon did not want usury. Napoleon was eventually poisoned. And why was he poisoned at age 51 when he was in prison? The only thing was that they were always afraid that if he comes back, he'll again become a threat to their usurious practices. So, and it has been established now by an analysis of his hair that he died of cyanide poisoning following chronic arsenic intoxication. And that has been carried out by a lab, Harvard lab in England, and that has also been confirmed by FBI labs, that the amount of poison present in his hair is consistent with cyanide poisoning. So we have at least two important labs which have confirmed that he was killed. And why was he killed when he was no longer in power, when he was in prison? What was the fear? So these assassinations, they are very surgical. They terminate anyone who they feel will threaten their usurious practices. So Napoleon, I think, did not believe in usury. And that he had, and
he,
in fact,
he banned the Jews from practice of usury, I understand.
Yes, yes. He came to an agreement with them, and then they agreed not to engage in usury, at least the French Jews. But of course, then the if usury is banned, then what would the banking families do? So they had to, you know, push the, and they were perpetually pushing him into wars. You know, they were starting with, I think, 1805 or 1806, and it was always England was always involved, because England was you know, in the year 1805, he was faced with a coalition of England, Austria, and Russia. In 1806 and 1807, by a coalition of England, Prussia, and Russia. In 1808 and 1809, by a coalition of England, Spain, and Austria. And in 1812, by a coalition of England and Russia, which in the following year was enlarged to include Prussia and Austria also. So it is always England in alliance with certain other powers. And England was a Rothschild fiefdom, everybody knows that. And England has been the den of the banking families, the real seat of trouble for the rest of mankind. So I don't think that... And Napoleon did not really want to go to war with these countries. He was a good general. He knew that he could not fight them all at the same time, and there was no point in fighting them. But the wars were thrust on him. And David Pitcock has pointed out that his Russian campaign was not a misjudged, reckless affair, but a situation forced upon him through a treacherous betrayal. This is the conclusion to which he comes after going through McNair Wilson's book, which was published in 1936 after some documents had been released. So, because Napoleon was against the banking families and the usurious practices, Napoleon has been maligned. Anybody who goes against these families and their practices is maligned in history. And anybody who supports them, no matter how bad he is always portrayed in a good light. For example, Churchill. There was a survey some time ago which showed that Churchill is considered as the greatest Briton ever, according to polls. But Churchill had sold himself so cheaply to the bankers, everybody knows that. And David Ewing has done so much to expose what he did, among others. And I went a couple of times to the British Parliament, the House of Commons. And I noticed that they had statues there. And all the statues that were there were of prime ministers who had been involved in strengthening the banking families and going against the interest of the common man, whether it was Disraeli, whether it was Margaret Thatcher and others. And they tried to put a statue of Tony Blair as well, but there was so much resistance that they couldn't manage to do that. So that is how they go about what about building their own people and about maligning those who oppose them.
But there's a big exception, and that would be Abraham Lincoln, who is held up as a great hero by the establishment, and yet who, you argue, was killed by the same banking cabal that killed Napoleon.
Yes, because he had issued the greenbacks, and he had prevailed in the war, so he had become strong that way, and he had to be eliminated. And it's not me, it's everybody who's gone into this has indicated. I have so many books which state that, and even his own granddaughter, I think, Ozella Forrester, has said that Booth, of the murderer Wilkes Booth, she has said that John Wilkes Booth had at that time something like $6,500 in cash in his pocket on his person when he had assassinated. So much money cannot come from ordinary people. It can come only from the bankers. This is 1864-65, and $6,500 at that time was a huge sum of money to carry on one's person. And Lincoln himself had said that he has an enemy in the South, and he has these corporations at the back, and he does not know which is the bigger enemy. So Lincoln was aware that the corporations were his enemies, and that included, of course, the bankers.
And I believe the official story of the Lincoln assassination admits that there were others who conspired with Booth, and yet somehow the mythical sort of lone assassin narrative blaming Booth as a Southern partisan seems to have prevailed in the same way the myth of Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone nut, lone communist nut, and Sirhan Sirhan, the lone Palestinian nut. These myths seem to persist, even when, in this case of Lincoln, the official history admits that it was a conspiracy, and yet people's impression is that it was a lone nut.
Because the bankers control the narrative through their control of the publishing industry and their control of media. And that is the problem. One has to read a lot and a lot of dissenting opinion, and that dissenting opinion is not easily available. Then one can see that, yes, the narrative that is being pushed forward in the mainstream media and the mainstream publishing houses is not correct. But for them, it works because most of the people don't have time to read things, and most of people don't have the habit of reading things too much or going into things. So they manage to hold on to the public mind that way. And then they have control over the textbooks because they have their persons. I remember that at the end of World War I, they contacted Charles Beard and Mary R. Beard to write a sanitized history, and they refused. And then there were discussions which I think came out because somebody had to, the Congress, in 1950s, Congress had set up a select committee on un-American activities of the bankers. And in that, they were able to access records of the Carnegie Foundation and others. And it turned out that there were discussions that they said, we will have our own stable of historians. And they set up the American Historical Association, and they gave it, I think, like about $500 million at that time in the early 20s. So that, and then they sent also young people to England for PhDs in history, and then they brought them back and planted them in various universities. So textbooks are very important. What is taught in the universities is also controlled, and that is how they control the narrative.
So what do you think would be the best strategy for changing this, or how can you envision that some kind of change in this bankster power could happen? They've been dominating much of the world for centuries. What could change that?
I think people, because the policies that they pursue lead to a lot of unhappiness and pain for people, and with the rise of other alternate sources of information like the internet, even though their companies may control people are becoming more aware of that. And that is why, for example, you see that Robert Kennedy Jr. has got so popular. And that is why even Trump has some popularity despite being framed in many false cases and things like Russiagate, which of course is false. So that is the only way that people should become aware and people should speak out, because to speak out is also very important. One must realize that if you are silent, you become complicit. So you must first understand and then you must speak out. And that pressure is very, very important. And it is, they're not people who cannot be defeated. And they're not people who are so secure. They're afraid of only one thing, and that is people becoming aware of what they do. And that I have noticed even in this country now, people, young people are quite aware of these things. I was surprised. And they look at the internet, they find out things, and nobody seems to pay much attention now to the mainstream media these days.
Yeah, I think it may actually be better in Pakistan. I remember seeing that poll showing that only 3% of Pakistanis believed that Al-Qaeda did 9/11. That was many years ago. And I was very favorably impressed by the awareness of the people of Pakistan at that time, because here in the United States, I think at the high point, we had 36% of the people saying that it was likely that 9/11 was a false flag. But in Pakistan, it seems like that's the strong majority opinion. And I've noticed in other Islamic countries as well, people seem to be much more open to these things than they are in the West.
Yes, that is true. The only problem is that the people who occupy these seats of power, the prime ministers and the presidents, they are usually brought there by powerful interests in the global establishment, Anglo-American establishment, and they will not speak about it. And people don't have a very high opinion. People don't like, people really dislike their rulers in our countries. The opinion about the rulers is very, very low. People know they're corrupt. People know they're dishonest. People know they have no integrity and they have no spine. But to have an organized movement that will bring the right kind of people in power seems very difficult, because that will require money. Elections have one problem. Elections require money, and that favors the moneyed people. And even in this country, people contest elections for the members of parliament, and they spend a lot of money. And when they come in power, they not only get that money back through dishonest means, they get much more than that back. And that is now a business, to get into power and make money.
Well, historically, many of the big changes in history have happened when elites have split, and there have been forces within the elite and then people in aspiring elites that have wanted to change things, and have in some cases joined with the people to change things. I mentioned in the first hour, I think I was reading Peter Churchin's new book, End Times, and he's accurately predicted the chaos happening now and the polarization in the United States. And you know, he does note that it is elites and aspirants to join, people who want to join the elites, who do have an inordinate effect on, you know, what happens politically, and who spearhead these kinds of revolutions and major changes. And I wonder if there is a part of the elites that could rise up against the bankster element. There certainly, here in the United States, we have a history of these older kind of America First elites, people like Henry Ford and so on, who were strongly opposed to the banking families.
Yes.
Is there any way that that could come back, that people like maybe Elon Musk and others might turn against the bankster elites?
That possibility is always there. And as I said, if God or nature is merciful, because the U.S. has gone off course, and the people of the U.S. know that, and they would like to see it back on course for the ideals for which it was built up. And so that might happen, but they are very, very clever. They have this electoral system. They have two parties. They manage the two parties. They manage the candidates. And any candidates who can become a threat for them are either maligned by the media or eliminated in the preliminary stages. But if by chance, like John Kennedy did win, if by chance somebody wins, then things can happen. I think even if RF Kennedy wins, he has very clear views on, for example, the pandemics and things like that. It could make a difference. If Trump wins, Trump is not an intellectual, not an academic, but Trump at least does not want war. And Trump wants America to prosper through business practices. But then the bankers have people who surround every president of the United States of America. If you look at the cabinets, if you look at the advisors, and you see how many of them are, for example, dual nationals of U.S. and Israel, you will see that it's not going to be easy. Someone who really understands these matters, if he comes to power, then he can change things.
Interesting. It seems to me RFK Jr. really wants to win, and that's why he's running as a Democrat rather than an independent, and that's why he's saying these ridiculous things to placate Israel. But it looks like that his vision is not so much to get power and then use his power to clobber his enemies, but rather it's to get power and then try to have some kind of healing of the divide, as he puts it, somehow trying to sweet talk these nefarious people into being a bit more reasonable. And that strikes me as a really big task. And indeed, it's kind of quixotic. But that seems to be his aim. Is there any chance of that? Can these banksters ever be reformed or at least made to be reasonable?
It's difficult, but it's not impossible, because if the world turns against them and they know that the world understands what they're doing, then they will be amenable to some change. But they're very clever. They, for example, have invested in China. There are two things that I came across. Firstly, in 2009...
We only have about 30 seconds left.
Okay. So it is possible. It is possible. Not impossible, but the probability is not very high, but it is possible.
Okay. Well, inshallah, we'll figure out a way. Thank you so much,
Dr.
Jack Emmerich. You're doing wonderful work. God bless you. Take care.
Thank you very much. You're always very kind. Thank you so much.
Okay. Looking forward to another one down the line. Inshallah.
Inshallah.
That's Dr. Mujahid Kamran, live from Pakistan. Kevin Barrett here, live from the Driftless region of Western Wisconsin. Back next week, God willing. See you then.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
Join me and the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization.
Things were not quite right, that everything was just ever so slightly askew.
Do you have, to paraphrase Morpheus, just a splinter in your mind.
If you're interested in hearing the latest information about UFOs, the paranormal,
ancient cultures and structures,
monatomic elements,
longevity,
fantastic discoveries in science,
download it to your brain,
then tune in to us. Hi, I'm Dave.
And I'm Mackie.
And we are Shiny Side Out, Sundays 2 to 4 a.m. Eastern. See you then.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the day, from this day to that, for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!